Okay, good morning. Welcome to pattern recognition. So what we want to do today is to wrap up this second lecture in the slides and talk about this whole general topic of probability decision theory. So last time, ended, I think, on this slide, we were talking about Bayes' formula. We talked about, we defined the concepts of a prior probability and a likelihood, and Bayes' formula gives us a way of mixing these two pieces of information. So suppose we know both the prior P of omega sub j and the likelihood P of x given omega sub j, and suppose also that we can measure x, that's our feature vector. How can we use this information intelligently to make a good decision about what pattern of class, what class a pattern belongs to? The joint probability of finding a pattern that is in category j and that this feature, this pattern has a feature value of x. And it's important to understand that that's sort of the way we're going to formulate problems in this course, is to try to look at joint probabilities and joint events as much as possible. So we want the joint probability that a pattern is in category j and that this pattern has a feature value of x, what we measured. And that's going to be p of omega sub j comma x. And that can be written in terms of posterior p of omega sub j given x and the marginal p of x. And we know from the laws of conditional probabilities that we can also write that as p of x given omega sub j times p of omega sub j. So we can rearrange terms and write that p of omega sub j given x is equal to p of x given omega sub j times p of omega sub j divided by p of x. And this denominator term, p of x, can be written as the sum of two probabilities, the p of x given omega sub j times p of omega sub j for each class. So we have the likelihood of x given omega sub j given class j times the prior of that class. So then we can state Bayes' formula, which says that p of omega sub j given x, this is the probability of a class assignment given a measurement x, is equal to the probability of the measurement given the class assignment times the prior divided by the evidence. And we can express this in words as the posterior is equal to, so the left-hand term we call posterior because it's what we really want. It's the probability of the class assignment given a measurement, that's essentially what the pattern recognition problem is, times the likelihood, which is the likelihood of a particular measurement given a class, times the prior divided by this denominator term, which we call the evidence. So what Bayes' formula tells us is that by measuring x, we can convert the prior probability p of omega sub j into a posterior probability p of omega sub j given x. Essentially, it gives us a way to go from the prior probability, which has really no information about the current measurements in it, or it's simply what we know about the problem prior to making any measurements, to a posterior probability, which describes the class assignment given an actual measurement. And the link between the two becomes essentially the likelihood, the p of x given omega sub j. So evidence can be viewed as a scale factor and is often ignored in optimization applications. So in a lot of applications, we're going to try to maximize this posterior. Well, maximization of the posterior involves maximizing this ratio with respect to the class assignment. And since the evidence is not a function of the class assignment directly, it's actually the sum of all possible class assignments, we can ignore p of x during the optimization. And we'll see that throughout this lecture and throughout the semester. So let's go back to our fish sorting problem, where we had a two-class problem, and for the sake of argument, we'll say that the prior of the class 1, omega sub 1, is equal to 2/3, and the prior of class 2, omega sub 2, is equal to 1/3. And here we plot then the left-hand plot contains the likelihood, the probability of x given omega sub I, and the right-hand plot gives us the posterior, the probability of omega sub I given x. Now, the data for this is in the book. It comes from, it's just comes from the problem space, but this shows you, gives you some feel for how these two functions are related to one another. So for every value of x, the posterior is half the sum to 1. And we can look at, for example, a particular value of x equals 14. The probability that it is in class omega sub 2 is 0.08, and the probability that's in class omega sub 1 is 0.92. And we see then that the sum of those two is equal to 1. So the posteriors have to sum to 1. The likelihoods, on the other hand, do not have a different behavior. You can sort of see the visually the relationship between these two functions. So let's now begin talking about how we can actually make intelligent decisions using this notion of Bayes' rule and using this notion of probabilities. So what is a decision rule? Well, a decision rule, and we're going to talk about a two-class problem just to keep things simple initially, but then we're going to generalize this to a multi-class problem in this chapter. So what is a decision rule? Well, a decision rule is simply a rule that says for an observation X, we make a decision about class omega sub 1 in some way, and otherwise we're going to decide omega sub 2. So a decision rule is a way of deciding between, making a choice between class omega sub 1 and class omega sub 2. Now, that it's important to understand how simple the pattern recognition problem is. In a two-class problem, the pattern recognition problem is simply a matter of choosing one class or another given a particular measurement. Okay, easy, right? And there's many ways we can do that. The simplest way we can do that is to toss a coin and just arbitrarily decide omega 1 versus omega 2. That's not such a bad strategy if your problem space lends itself to that. That kind of a strategy is often used in what are called Monte Carlo simulations. And sometimes it's also more recently you see things like that being used in applications like game theory. Whereas game theory is kind of an interesting area because rather than try to sort of understand the statistical underpinnings of a problem, one way to deal with, to try to understand outcomes of a problem is just to run lots of simulations and see what happens. So, for example, in areas like the military or in fact, a very interesting area now are all these computerized sports games like football games and things where you simply are running lots of simulations and trying to predict what the outcomes are by simulating the system you're trying to model. Now, that works well in terms of you can often understand what the likely outcomes are. The military has been using war games for many, many years as a very effective strategy, but that doesn't give you insight into the underlying problem. What we're trying to do here is not just really make decisions, but gain some insight into what are the root causes or what are the fundamental dimensions of importance of the problem. But if you simply want to make decisions, you can flip a coin, you can choose things based on priors, or you can build some very sophisticated algorithms to try to do this in a more intelligent way. It's important to remember that and we'll see this throughout the semester, that the performance of whatever algorithm you choose is always going to be compared to the performance of random guessing and the performance of guessing according to the prior information. Those are sort of baseline results that are very important. But our decision rule is going to be very simple. We're going to, and this is not the only decision rule that we have to use, but this is a very simple decision rule that makes sense, which is to simply choose class omega sub 1 if the probability of omega sub 1 given x is greater than the probability of omega sub 2 given x. If that's the case, we choose omega sub 1. Otherwise, we choose omega sub 2. Now, you're thinking, well, that's pretty obvious. I didn't need to take an 8,000 level course to be told that. But this is not the only decision rule you might use. In fact, If you follow, like, football, for example, and watch the football games this weekend, this decision rule didn't work too well this weekend. Because it really comes down to how accurate these models are. If you don't have a lot of faith in these models, the result from this decision rule is not going to be very good. So oftentimes, people in real life will not use a decision rule like this because they have additional information that's not comprehended in their model. For example, in the context of sporting events, well, weather plays a big role sometimes. Weather played some kind of a role this weekend, in fact. And that's often not taken into account in your computer models of these kinds of things. Though, actually, I think in some of the really sophisticated computer models, they probably do take into account weather. But when people set odds for sporting events and things, they often don't take into account the actual conditions like weather and things. Now, if we choose this decision rule, the probability of error is going to be simply associated with the problem with the situations where this rule does not work. So, for example, we can write that the probability of the error given x. Well, if it turns out that p of omega sub 2 given x is greater than p of omega sub 1 given x, but x was a member of omega 1, that's going to be an error. So the probability of error for this decision rule can be written as the probability of omega sub 2 given x when in fact x is a member of omega sub 1, and the probability of omega sub 1 given x when x is in fact a member of omega sub 2. And in a previous lecture, I pointed you to a nice write-up about this whole problem of how we compute probability of error if you've not seen that before in your probability classes. So the average probability of error then is given by the integral of this for all of x, and we can write that as the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of the probability of the error given x times p of x dx. And you'll note that this expression does take into account the probability of each measurement. It's not simply summing the errors, but it's weighting that by the probability of a particular measurement. And the probability of error given x for this kind of a decision rule is simply the minimum of these two posteriors, p of omega sub 1 given x and p of omega sub 2 given x. So if for every x we ensure that this probability of the error given x is as small as possible, in other words, if we try to minimize this term inside the integral, then we'll minimize the overall probability of error. Then the overall integral will be as small as possible. And therefore, we can say that Bayes' rule, which tries to minimize the probability of the error given the measurement, does in fact minimize the overall error rate. So this rule makes sense in that this is just a simple sort of proof of the fact that this rule makes sense because it does lead to minimizing the overall error rate. And it does that essentially by looking at a point-by-point minimization of the error. So we have our first decision rule. Now, the evidence, this p of x, it's essentially viewed as a scale factor that assures the conditional probability sum to 1. So the conditional probabilities, p of omega sub 1 given x plus p of omega sub 2 given x, those have to sum to 1 because that's a probability function. We can eliminate the scale factor, which appears on both sides of the equation. So if x is a... our decision rule says that x is a member of omega sub 1 if this, if you recall, let me go back to the previous slide for a second. So if you recall this decision rule, we can write each of these two terms in terms of a likelihood and a prior probability. So we can write that we're going to choose class omega sub 1 if p of x given omega sub 1 times p of omega sub 1 is greater than P of x given omega sub 2 times P of omega sub 2. So this is essentially what we call Bayes' rule. And there are a couple special cases of this which are important and which you may be familiar with. Let me go to the second one first. If these probabilities, these prior probabilities are equal, then we're essentially choosing based on which likelihood is greater. And that's essentially what's known as the maximum likelihood approach. And you may have be familiar, you may be, have done this and not even known it, but that it's very common in signal processing problems that don't use statistical methods to ignore prior probabilities. And that's simply then a matter of looking at the likelihood functions. But we also see now the importance that the priors have, because the priors can often change the results significantly, especially if one class is much more probable than another class. Another special case is if these likelihoods are equal, then essentially the measurement x gives us no useful information, and the optimal decision rule is simply done based on the prior probabilities. So that's kind of a bad case, because that means your model is not really giving you any additional information, and you'd be better off just guessing along according to the priors. Now, you will sort of look at this and say, well, that's never going to happen, but this can, in fact, happen if you have a really bad model. In fact, sometimes models can perform worse if they're poorly estimated or poorly developed. So it's always important to look at your baseline performance as the performance you would achieve using just the prior probabilities. That becomes kind of a baseline. You shouldn't do worse than that when you're developing an algorithm. You should always be able to do better than that. Now, let's first, we want to do two more things today. We want to generalize the two-class problem, and then we want to reformulate this in terms of something known as risk. Generalization of the two-class problem, there's a couple ways we can do this in the context of the example we've been talking about. One of the first things is we can, of course, have features which are more than two dimensions, and that's not a big issue. It's very common in signal processing applications these days to use a fairly high dimensional vector. In speech processing, we use, for speech recognition type applications, we use vectors ranging from 39 elements up into this, like 100, 120 elements. I think with some of the imaging work that some of you are doing, hyperspectral data and things, you're using, I think, features of more than about 100 features. And used to be more difficult to deal with such large feature vectors, but now we actually like to do that and let the learning machine figure out what are the good features, what are the bad features. A more important way that we generalize the problem, though, is an N-way classification, meaning that instead of two classes, we have more than two classes. And that means the decision surface is going to go from being something simple like a line to something more complicated, which we will call a hyperplane, and we'll talk about that later. A third way that we can generalize the problem, and this is actually very important, because this is really important part of almost any pattern recognition application, we can allow an action other than a decision to decide on the state of nature. And the most common thing that we do here is rejection, refusing to take an action when alternatives are close or when the confidence is low. And this is a difficult, sort of a tricky thing to deal with, because in a lot of research, you don't necessarily include the rejection hypothesis as an alternative. But in a lot of practical systems, you have to have a rejection hypothesis. You face this on a regular basis when you call in a telephone answering system and it says, speak, you know, one if you want this choice, speak two if you want this choice. And sometimes, no matter what you speak, it bounces you to the operator. And that's a case where it's not recognized what you said very well, and rather than make a choice, which is probably going to be an error, they just reject your input and send you to the operator as a default choice. In real applications, this is very important because it's a way of not angering your customers too much. But in research, it raises problems because then you have to trade off what is the cost of a rejection versus the cost of an error or a substitution, as we call a substitution error, making the wrong choice. And very often your application doesn't tell you that. That's really a function of the sort of the application and the customer trying to deliver that application. So very often we have to look at performance as a trade-off between substitution errors, incorrectly identifying the class, and rejection errors, rejecting the hypothesis altogether. And we'll talk about that later in the class. Now, another thing that we do, though, is to introduce a loss function, which is more general than the probability of error. And this is done because errors are not equally costly. And in a moment, we'll generalize this to something called risk. I cannot emphasize the importance of this. I cannot underemphasize the importance of this. Because in the research world, at least in the engineering research world, for many years now, we've tended to simply look at probability of error. But in real applications, errors are not equally costly. For example, when Katrina hit this area, most of the insurance companies involved went bankrupt. And this is a very interesting phenomenon because the whole principle of insurance is you pay money to sort of hope that when some kind of catastrophic event happens, you're covered. And the insurance companies lately with these catastrophic situations have found out that they can't afford to pay off all these claims when these events happen, so they go bankrupt. Well, that's not fair to you as a consumer because you paid all this money hoping that when the day came when you need to use that insurance, it should be available. Now, insurance companies are probably the best example of it's the nature of their business to essentially assess risk. And they have to make decisions about whether we're talking about car insurance, home insurance, or flood insurance, or all these things. They have to make decisions about how they're going to weight errors, because how they make their money is essentially by assessing risk. They make money by having you pay them money and them not having to pay you back money when catastrophic events happen. And so they have to decide, they have to decide that, for example, situations like Katrina are very catastrophic, and for that to happen, that alternative has to be weighted very heavily if they want to stay in business. So they assess risk so that they can basically determine what premiums you pay, and they go through very elaborate calculations to try to balance the cost of events or errors, because that's essentially what their business is. You pay them money, and then they take on risk for you. And as we learned with things like Katrina, their models were not very good because they were not really prepared to sustain this kind of catastrophic event. Well, it turns out they were very familiar with this. They just made a business decision that if something like Katrina happened, they wouldn't be able to pay it off and they'll just go bankrupt. And that was part of their business model. So it sort of takes on aspects of ethics and things. And I'm not implying necessarily that the insurance companies are bad, but it's just they have a real fundamental problem that they have to look at how likely it is that you're going to get into a relatively minor traffic accident versus how likely it is that you're going to get into a really bad traffic accident where they're going to have to pay out a lot of money. So they are a prime example of how they have to look at things beyond just probability of error, because certain types of errors are very costly to them. So what we're going to do is to replace the scalar x by a vector x, and we'll use boldface notation for the vector. And we're going to do this, then we're going to then talk about a d-dimensional Euclidean space, which we'll call R superscript D. And that simply represents a dimensional space that's where each dimension corresponds to one element of the feature vector. Now, it's always nice in pattern recognition to work in two dimensions because we can easily visualize things. The book also does a nice job of visualizing some things in three dimensions. Unfortunately, it's very hard for humans to visualize in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 39, 150 dimensions, which is where we tend to work in our actual problem space. So, a lot of what we'll do, we'll focus on examples that can be demonstrated in two dimensions because it's easy to visualize those. So let's now generalize the loss function. Let's let this collection omega 1 through omega sub c be a set of c categories, and let's let alpha sub 1 through alpha sub a be the set of a possible actions. And let's let lambda of alpha sub I given omega sub j be the loss incurred for taking action alpha sub I when the state of nature is in fact omega sub j. So this is simply adding another function on top of our decision rule, which says when I'm about to choose a class assignment omega sub j, this function is going to essentially let me compute the cost of making that decision. Now, if omega sub j is correct, then the loss could be very low. If omega sub j is incorrect, the loss could be very high. So we introduce this notion of a loss function, and then we'll eventually convert our posteriors to what's called a risk function. So the posterior p of omega sub j given x, this can be computed from Bayes' rule, as we've seen before, as the likelihood times the prior over the evidence, where the evidence is this sum over the c classes now of the likelihood times the prior. Now, using this notion of a loss function, the expected loss from taking action alpha sub I is going to be the sum, the weighted sum essentially, of these posteriors. So we're going to take over the C classes. We have the expected loss or the risk of alpha sub I given X is going to be the sum over C classes of this lambda of alpha sub I given X times the posterior P of omega sub j given X. Now, this isn't the only way to formulate risk, but this is perhaps the most common way to formulate risk. So it's just a function. It's just essentially a weighted sum of our posteriors. But the thing to recognize about this is that this, in computing the expected loss for an action, we're summing over all classes, and we're taking into account the posteriors for each one of those classes. So it's a way of looking across all the classes and essentially asking the question, what is the cost associated with assigning the input vector x to omega to each class, omega 1, omega 2, omega 3, all the way through omega c. And we're going to weight the costs of those decisions by an additional loss function. Okay, now this is still pretty abstract, and I recognize that, and it took me a while when we first started looking at this many years ago to sort of feel comfortable with this, but for the moment, just think of it as another function of the posteriors. It's just a functional mapping between the posteriors and what we'll eventually come to know as risk. And again, that insurance companies essentially focus on what's a good model for this lambda. And we'll talk about a couple different ways this can be interpreted today. So an expected loss is called a risk. This R of alpha sub I given X is called the conditional risk because it's conditioned on a feature vector. And if you were, for example, to integrate across all possible feature vectors, then you would get the overall risk. And that's essentially what insurance companies live or die by is this overall risk for a particular problem space. A general decision rule is a function, alpha sub I, which tells us which action to take for every possible observation. And in a moment, I'll show you how we can reformulate our Bayesian decision rule in terms of this risk function and these alphas. If we choose alpha of x so that this conditional risk is as small as possible for every value of x, then the overall risk will be minimized. This is something that we'll see over and over again when we work with probabilities. Since the overall risk is related to the conditional risk by this integral, we know that if we minimize the conditional risk for every value of x, then we must in turn be minimizing the overall risk. So we can compute the conditional risk for every alpha and select the action that minimizes this conditional risk. And we'll call this solution R star, and this is referred to as the Bayesian risk or Bayes' risk. The Bayes' risk is the best performance that can be achieved for a given data set or problem definition. So the Bayes' risk is essentially point by point minimization of this conditional risk. And therefore the Bayes' risk becomes another important baseline or bound for how you can do on a pattern recognition problem. Okay, so again, still a little bit abstract, but now we'll try to give this a little more meat in terms of our two-class problem. So let's look at our two-category classification problem, and let's see if we can work through this a little more. So let's let alpha sub 1 correspond to omega sub 1, and alpha sub 2 correspond to omega sub 2. And we're going to call this lambda sub ij be essentially the function lambda of alpha sub I given omega sub j. So this risk function, which in general could be some complicated function, we're going to simply say, let's let it, for a two-class problem, let's let it consist of four values, four free variables, lambda 1, 1, lambda 1, 2, lambda 2, 1, lambda 2, 2. And these are just going to be the costs of the associated errors or events. So the conditional risk, the risk in alpha sub 1 is going to be the sum of two things, lambda 1, 1 times p of omega sub 1 given x plus lambda 1, 2 times p of omega 2 given x. So what this represents is essentially we have the posterior for choosing class omega sub 1, and this lambda 1, 1 you can think about as the case where that posterior choice was the right choice. This lambda 1, 2 you can think of as that posterior choice was the wrong choice. You chose omega 2, but it was in fact class omega sub 1. And then this lambda 2, 1 similarly is going to be you chose class 1 and it should have been class 2. And lambda sub 2, 2 is you chose class 2 and it was in fact class 2. So we can essentially use these weights to control the penalties for whether we made a correct choice or whether we made an incorrect choice. And that's essentially one way that we trade off these things. You could, for example, be working a problem space where it's very, very important, where you're rewarded very heavily for being correct and you don't really care about making errors. Or you could work in a problem space where it's not the issue of being correct isn't nearly as important as never being incorrect. So in that case, you would weight the incorrect choices very large, and you'd get very little reward for being correct. What is an example of a situation like that? Well, nuclear weapon proliferation is a very good example of that. The whole nuclear weapon industry is designed around avoiding a fatal mistake. So they go every day, they go through practice runs, where they're never really rewarded for being correct, but the whole industry is built on hopefully never having to actually use this option. So if you look at how they design systems in that case, they use many, many fail-safe measures. You have multiple people making decisions at multiple stages so that hopefully no decision will ever be made incorrectly because there's 10 or 15 critical humans in the loop before a final decision is made. So our decision rule, if we now want to operate on risk rather than on probability of error, our decision rule is going to be choose omega sub 1 if the risk, R of alpha sub 1 given x, is less than R of alpha sub 2 given x. Otherwise, decide omega sub 2. And this results in the equivalent rule of choosing omega sub 1 if lambda 2 1 minus lambda 1 1 times p of x given omega sub 1 is greater than lambda 1 2 times lambda 2 2 times p of x given omega sub 2. So this is a nice way of showing that by introducing this additional concept of risk, we're no longer simply doing the decision rule is no longer based solely on the posteriors. We'll eventually call this maximum a posteriori decoding. But it now factors in the weights associated with the risk. This is another reason why whenever you set up, this sort of shows you directly that whenever you set up an evaluation of algorithms, for example, in my community, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, conducts the evaluations, and they will always publish a performance metric for how they're going to weight the different types of errors you make in a speech recognition problem. Well, we will very quickly then optimize our systems based on those weights. Because we can do, if they define the metric a certain way, we can always do best if we optimize the system according to that metric. And that metric not only includes, you know, making errors, but it includes weights on the relative cost of those errors. So you'll see when you get a little further in your research, you'll see this happens all the time. Whenever you go into one of these competitions, the really smart research groups reverse engineer the performance metrics. And often that's the difference between a winning and a losing team. Not the sort of underlying science of the algorithm, which is what you think it's all about. Okay, so by employing Bayes' formula, we can replace the posteriors by prior probabilities and conditional density. So we can write our decision rule this way in terms of now the likelihoods times the priors. And this term is positive, our decision rule then essentially becomes choose omega 1 if the ratio of the likelihoods is greater than the ratio of the priors times these weights. And that's kind of an interesting way to look at things because it now shows you how these weights, the cost of the errors and the priors, are measured against the likelihoods. And we'll go through some simplifications of this in a moment. But so if the loss factors are identical and the prior probabilities are equal, this reduces to a standard likelihood ratio. And this is essentially where the maximum likelihood decoding comes from. If your priors are equal and if these weights are all equal, then essentially this term becomes 1 and you just have your decision rule becomes choosing things based on the likelihood function, and that's what we call maximum likelihood decoding. However, you can also see that if the weights are equal, then you can see how the priors play into things, and you can also see that these weights can influence your decision surface. So when someone brings you a problem, you have to ask them questions like, what are the costs of making these types of errors? And the customer will usually say, well, I don't know. You figure that out. And then you'll deliver a system to the customer, and they will say, well, I don't like that system. you laugh about this, but I can tell you, I mean, I've been through this many times in my career. One of the ones that was most striking was when we delivered one of the first voice verification systems to Sprint. This was about 15 years ago when I was at Texas Instruments. And we essentially built the system and made all these decisions. And we brought the system up one weekend, and the executive vice president overseeing the project at Sprint called in the system, and it failed. And we got a call very quickly that said, you got to fix that. The VP who's funding this project says the system doesn't work. Well, guess what? That was a perfect example of where, obviously, there were some users and some types of errors for those users that were much more important than everyone else. And you'll find this very often in science, especially when you do demos for important customers. You know, they will demand a performance that, you know, you have to satisfy them, basically. And you'll say, well, you know, on the average, for all of your customers, the system's going to work fine, just relax. But, you know, vice presidents don't look at the world that way. And you have to, we essentially, because of that, had to change the weights we associated with rejections. I don't remember if he was, I think he might have been rejected or something, and we had to change the weights associated with that. Now, let's try to look at a simplification of the risk. Let's talk about minimum error rate. So consider a symmetrical 0-1 loss function. Consider a situation where the errors are essentially equally, have equal weight. So when I is equal to J, that's a correct recognition, you can say, and there's no cost associated, no loss associated with that. When I is not equal to J, all the losses have the same cost. So the conditional risk can be written as the sum over the C classes, we've seen this before, of the conditional risk for each alpha times the posterior. And because all of these, because of the symmetry of this loss function, this just becomes a sum of the posteriors when J is not equal to I, because when I is equal to J, the weight goes to zero and that term drops out. And this can just be written as 1 minus the posterior of omega sub I given X, because this term is essentially all of the posteriors for when J is not equal to I, and we said that the posteriors have to sum to 1. So we can write the conditional risk then as 1 minus the probability of omega sub I given X. So the conditional risk for alpha sub I is essentially the average probability of error. So to minimize error, we simply have to maximize the probability of omega sub I given X. And this is known as maximum a posteriori decoding, or MAP decoding. And that's one of the most common ways we do pattern recognition, essentially, by trying to maximize the posterior. And the key thing here now is that we see that maximizing the posterior minimizes the average probability of error. But it does that by taking into account the prior probabilities. So here's an example of minimum error rate classification for the two-class problem that we've been looking at. Here we have the conditionals, here we have the posteriors, and now we have, and we take the ratio of those posteriors. So we take the ratio of the likelihoods for the two classes, assuming that in this case, you would assume that the classes are equally probable, and then we have now a function, a single scalar function, that tells us, which we can use then to define regions where we assign data to omega sub 1 and omega sub 2. So this is just a visualization of the two-class decision rule that we've been talking about. Now, as we've alluded to, minimizing the overall risk or minimizing the probability of error isn't the only criterion that we have to use in a pattern recognition problem. It's the one that we will use most this semester, but it's not necessarily the only one that we have to use. There are other criteria, such as minimizing the worst overall risk. This is called the mini-max criterion, minimizing the maximum risk. And this is very common in industries that deal with catastrophes, such as when you're building bridges, for example. We talked a little bit about insurance. Another example of this is bridges. When you're building bridges, you have to make some decision about what's the worst case condition that's going to happen for that bridge. For example, if the bridge is carrying automobile traffic, you have to decide what's the most number of automobiles that can be on that bridge at any point in time, or what's the most amount of weight that can be on that bridge at any time. Well, there are a couple ways you could arrive at that. You could assume you could measure daily traffic in terms of weight and then make some projections based on that. Or you could do a calculation where you say something like, well, what's the worst case situation? I have 18-wheeled trucks. Every one of those 18-wheeled trucks is filled with concrete or, I don't know, some really heavy material. And they're all lined up. There's a big traffic jam, so they're all sitting on the bridge at the same time. Now, that's going to give you an estimate which is really bad, really conservative. And if you build the bridge to that condition, you may be wasting a lot of money in construction materials. So you have to decide sort of what's the probability of that event and how important am I going to consider that event in the overall scheme of things. And as usually happens with these kinds of things, everything works fine most of the time, but every 100 years or so, some anomalous event happens, like there's a big traffic jam, the bridge is full, the wind's blowing in a certain direction, and one of the bolts decides to break, and now you have, you know, a catastrophe. And it happens all the time, and it's very, very sad, but some engineer made that decision many years ago when that structure was designed, and it was based on this kind of risk minimization. We can actually derive, I don't think we'll have enough time to do this today, but we can derive sort of conditions for what happens under the min-max criterion. We can actually write for our two-class problem, and we can sort of simplify components of that risk. And I don't have time to go through all this today, but the book doesn't have all the details, so I've actually written up notes where we have some of the details of the calculations. And what I really wanted to just sort of show here, it's mostly simple algebra, but what comes out of that is essentially a function where we can look at the probability of error as a function of the prior probabilities, and then our decision rule becomes essentially how we interpret this graph. And the min-max criterion is based on looking at the Bayes' error rate for each value of the feature vector. And we can write an expression for the min-max risk in terms of our loss functions. Let's see, I think there's one more. We won't go through the details today, but you've got the details in the note. Now, a second criterion that's also used is something known as the Neyman-Pearson criterion. And this guarantees that the total risk is less than some fixed cost or constant. So in this visualization of the min-max criterion, this is actually the Neyman-Pearson criterion. We're following a rule which guarantees that the total risk is less than some fixed constant or cost. So in this case, we minimize the risk subject to this constraint that the total risk must be less than some constant. You can think about this in a pattern recognition sense. If you go back to our salmon sea bass problem, this would be equivalent to saying something like, build me a classifier such that the overall classification error rate is less than 1%. I don't care whether it's 0.5%, 0.25%, or 0.1%. Just make sure it's less than 1%. That's a different criterion than the min-max criterion, where you're saying just make sure that the maximum risk is less than some number. This is trying to make sure that the overall risk is below a constant. This solutions of this often have to be done numerically. It's a bit intractable, but you'll see in the literature, you'll see sometimes people talk about Neyman-Pearson, and we'll come back to this when we talk a little bit more about decision rules. But from a conceptual point of view, this is simply a decision surface that's designed to guarantee that the total risk is less than some fixed constant or cost. So that's sort of the third way we've talked about today. Min-max is the second way, where we're trying to minimize the maximum risk. So we talked today about Bayes' formula, which factors a posterior into a combination of a likelihood, prior, and the evidence. We talked about a Bayes' decision rule, which is a way that we can then make a decision about a class assignment based on Bayes' formula, and the Bayes' decision rule is designed to produce the minimum error. And then we talked about Bayes' risk, which is a bound on the performance of a classification system if we use Bayes' rule. And then we generalize that to show that there are other decision rules we could arrive at based on concepts such as the min-max criterion or the Neyman-Pearson criterion. Now, we'll spend most of the semester on Bayes' decision rule and applying that in different ways. We won't really talk about these too much, but I just wanted to introduce them so you get an idea that there's something other than the Bayesian, what's often called the Bayesian approach. Okay, so we'll pick this up on Wednesday. Now I have assigned, the homework assignments are out there and the solutions and all that. So as we get through the material in the course, you'll be able to start working the homework problems.